People don't fail at real estate because they suck. They fail because there's too many ways to succeed. That's why I suggest you focus on the most important skill in all of real estate, which is finding deals. I'm Colbert Johnson, and in this podcast, I share the exact steps I've used to source 400 deals by age 24. This will allow you to do three things: control your deal flow, make unlimited income, and build your empire as an off-market operator.
Yeah, so I got into real estate fresh, 18 years old. I wasted no time. My whole family had been in it. So mom is an agent, brother's an agent, grandma was an agent. So I had a lot. I understood the basic lingo of the business right off the bat. So it wasn't too much of a curve at the beginning. And then I absolutely hated being a real estate agent, all due respect to real estate agents. So I finally decided that wasn't for me. And that kind of finally happened when I went to Caliber Real Estate and hung my license there with Ian and started to kind of learn the off-market side. And it seemed, you know, a lot cooler to me, a lot more fun. They were having these weekly meetups at the time, so I got to sit on some of those and get my feet wet. And then that kind of opened my eyes to the whole off-market, wholesaling, flipping, development, that whole side of the business. And then from there, I just kind of, you know, jumped in with both feet.
So I got a question for you. You were 18, you went into real estate. Most people at 18 feel like this desire, maybe not desire, but this pull towards going to college. Did you even think about that, or did?
I went for a semester. Yeah. So I went down to a school in Southern California to play basketball originally. But I went down for the first semester and just decided that, you know, I didn't want to spend that kind of money for what I was learning there.
Gotcha. And then, so you went back, you started in the agent side up in Seattle area.
Yep. Seattle, Bellevue.
Okay. And then you found Ian, of course. Funny, I was actually on the phone with Fred this morning, his partner in Rain City. So they're doing a happy hour next week that I'm going to, partake in with them. But okay, so you found Caliber, you got into the investment side. That obviously turned into a lot more. Where did it kind of go from there?
Well, from there, my mom actually was the one that dragged me to the Caliber office one night for one of their meetups and sat in Ian's office. And from there, my partner at the time, Paul, we've separated since, but we were driving for dollars. And like, I don't know if you're too familiar with this area, but like Medina, Clyde Hill, like just, you know, doing everything that people do when they first get started and trying to make it happen. And finally, my mom brought us this this deal in Seattle, Ballard area, like $800,000 purchase price for her clients that didn't want to put it on the market. They had a bad reverse mortgage on it, just wanted out of it. So we took it to a developer who, two of my buddies I've been learning a lot from at the time, Hayden and Chris, had, and we sold it to him. It was a crazy deal. We like sold them on building up two stories for a view of the whole Puget Sound. Like a deal, we've never done a deal like it since, but the total check was about 105 grand on that deal. And then split a couple ways, but that was the jump start into actually, you know, being able to push this forward.
Did you follow that deal through and see what they did with the end product? Because you basically, we've got a product called Flipping Teardowns, which it's become progressively more difficult over time with the amount of competition. But we used to go in and find these teardowns and we get them for a screaming deal. And we built a bunch of them and then we'd flip a bunch. And there was a lot that we did. And I know people that did that made, you know, 100 grand on a teardown flip, because you're buying it as the house, you're selling it as the dirt, and you could kind of arbitrage that value there. What did those guys do with it? They bought the dirt for 800 grand, you said.
So unfortunately, it still is sitting there at the top.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, it's just sitting, waiting. I follow up once in a while, but yeah, I don't really know the full scoop of why it's still sitting there. It's been 2 years.
Okay. Well, shit happens, folks. So who knows, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, they bought it. You sold it.
Yeah.
All right. So you were in the agent side. You did that deal. It obviously grew quickly from there. Where did it go from there?
From there, we just, we spent a good amount of money reaching out to people who are already in the industry and paying them to go fly down and learn kind of some of their systems and operations and what they had going on under the hood. And then we just started cold calling. I mean, we were in my, at the time, I was living with my parents. So me and my partner, Paul, we were up in my parents' pretty much attic calling, you know, 6 hours a day, just handing the phone back and forth, just our cell phones, just getting after it.
You guys got balls of steel.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting times. And then eventually we hired one virtual assistant to call for us, and that got us another few deals. And from there, we kept paying people to learn, kept adjusting and pivoting. And then through a few lawsuits and losing money and bad deals and whatnot, we just kept our foot on the gas, really all it was.
What was that initial list that you were cold calling? Was it just anybody?
It was a random list we got from our title company. There was nothing special to it. There was no filtering anything out. It was just, we had it on a Google sheet. We didn't have a CRM at the time or anything. We had a Google sheet and we'd highlight stuff green. And then those were our people we were following up with consistently.
Gotcha. All right. So pedal to the metal. You guys started in mom's attic calling. Obviously you got some stick, you got some deal flow. In addition to that 105K first check, how did that turn into what Elliot described to me as multiple markets and a ginormous operation in a probably very short amount of time?
Yeah, very short amount of time. So that we hired our first like in-house acquisition guy and got an office about 6 months after our first deal. So pretty quickly. It was not a smart office move. It was a 3-year personally guaranteed lease at 19 years old for like 2,000 square feet. So like really aggressive.
How much was that lease payment each month?
It's like 4,200.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's deep, right?
Yeah. So we were like, again, one of the mistakes too, we don't need that much space, but I'm in it right now. We still have it and we have a team in it now. But at the time it was us, we hired one guy. So we had three people in this massive office and just slowly we just started bringing on word of mouth, one guy after another. Until we had, at one point we had 6 guys on our sales floor and then an operations transactions manager in-house. And then me and Paul, we had 9 guys in here at one point and we were in 5-6 different markets doing, you know, 8-ish deals a month. But that, as cool as that sounds, it was actually the most stressful, like crazy time. We lost a bunch of money. It was just, yeah, it was a mess.
So I want to get into that a little more, but as you were hiring, as you were growing, who were the first people that you hired? Did you hire sales guys to just cold call? Were you guys sending direct mail or were you just hitting the phones and trying to get deals that way?
Our cold calling at that point was outsourced. So we had a center. We still use them in the Philippines and across a couple of other places too that were part of it. But so we outsourced that. And then we had our internal sales guys just in our CRM making up follow-up calls every single day. But we weren't mailing, no. At the time, we were just, for about a year and a half, we were only cold calling. That's all we did.
What would you say? So here's, cold calling works, obviously, right? One thing I found with it, and tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like you get three types of people you talk to. First person's like, you know, F you, I don't have anything to say, right? The second type is somebody that will talk, but it's kind of expediting a conversation that you may not have had just sending direct mail or some sort of passive marketing channel. But that person wants 100%, 120% of retail, make me move price, something like that. And then you've got your third person, which is maybe somebody that would have responded to a direct mail piece or a text message or an RVM or something along those lines, but maybe not. And timing's right and they're willing to chat and there's some type of a situation. Combine that with the fact that they have a lot of equity and that's your opportunity call. Is there another bucket or do I have it pretty well?
No, you have it spot on. Yeah. Spot okay. on. Yeah. All right. All right. And for us, you know, cold calling worked because we got super targeted and we had a lot of volume. It's a 90 to 120 day, lead to contract period.
It is. Okay. So that's what you guys saw. So like first call on, I guess what's your favorite list? Let's just say for everybody. To
listen. Our favorite, we stack them a little bit now, but like when we were just starting, we were just hammering absentee lists.
Okay. So that's it. But you'd call them and then it'd be like, 6 weeks from that first conversation to usually a close if something was going to be a deal?
Yeah. Or more. I mean, 90 to 120 days is what, okay. So like, yeah, it's interesting because like now we do a bunch of mail and online stuff and it's a much quicker sales cycle. But for cold calling, yeah, it's definitely the hardest, most intensive follow-up.
I think that's the thing that most people don't realize is that, you know, you think you're just going to call somebody and be like, hey, do you want to sell your house? And they're like, yeah, sure. I'll take $5. And you're like, great, let's do it. Right. Yeah. Like it doesn't seem to work like that. It seems to me like it's a great tool for kind of expediting those conversations that we talked about, but then you've got to actually follow up on those conversations to kind of further that relationship.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, if we didn't have, like, if you don't have really, I mean, it's a sales game after that point. So you can have, you know, as many cold call leads as you want coming in. And if you can't, you know, handle the follow-up and really build the relationship, that nothing's going to happen.
How did you manage the guys that are supposed to be doing follow-up? Because that's a whole other beast in itself, right? I mean, basically keeping guys motivated on the floor to be like, what are you guys doing? You got leads in the queue, you know?
It's like a separate business. It's like marketing is like its own business. The sales side is like its own business. So it's interesting, but we have pretty in-depth KPI tracking. When we first started, we didn't. When we first started, it was all, hey, I mean, they're pretty much all commission. So if they wanted to get paid, they had to bring deals in. So it was kind of all, hey, you guys are bringing in money or you aren't. We weren't really looking too deep under the hood on that. But now we do, we track everything and make sure they're on the ball.
Gotcha. When you hired those guys straight commission, do you feel like that hurt you, or do you feel like you got good talent, guys that were willing to call with that long of a sales cycle, or were you giving them draws to kind of entice people?
Being like 19 at the time, it was hard to recruit like full salary. Hey, come to our weird office in Renton that's not furnished and sit in our little boiler room and call with us. So we couldn't really get like top, you know, we couldn't go get someone from Zillow who's a bunch of sales experience. So luckily our first guy we hired, Mike, who's still with us. He was ex-military, just was on his stuff, and he reached out to me and he was all commissioned and started bringing deals in right off the bat. But it was tricky. It was tricky. I think it hurt us because we lost some good guys that we had, because we tried to stick with that all commission model. But now we're more balanced for sure.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Loch Ness Monster. That's why I'm kind of digging in a little bit. Cause it's hard to make that, you know, work, that magical salesperson that's straight commission that, you know, brings in money and makes a lot of money for the company, but you don't have the obligation of overhead to them. Like, they exist, but they're pretty damn hard to find, at least in my experience.
Yeah. And we had a few other variables that made it not work. Like, we were in like St. Louis and a bunch of other markets where an assignment fee is like $5,000. So they have to do 6 deals in a month to bring home, you know, a fair amount of money, you know, at least enough to pay their bills. So we had guys quitting because of that. And I mean, that's when some of our biggest months in revenue, I talked, you know, to Elliot, some of the other guys about this a lot, but some of our biggest months in revenue, like upper, like almost $200,000, we were taking home as owners, like $7,000 to $10,000. And we thought it was awesome. We saw everyone on Instagram running around with checks, like, hey, look, we did 46 deals last month. But really, when you get to that point, you realize that you're not sleeping at night. You're constantly hiring and firing people. Your systems are breaking every single day, and you're pretty much walking with way less than you would at a you know, half that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a realization a lot of people come to, just depending on what that end business looks like. I mean, it's a Titanic at some point, right? So you got to keep feeding the Titanic if you want more and more and more. But so I'm trying to understand like the growth here. So you started in Seattle area. How did you pick the next, you know, handful of markets that you guys went to?
Honestly, at first it was pretty random. It was like, well, we talked to that guy. He's in that market. He seems to be making money. Let's just throw a bunch of marketing out there and see what happens. And it worked. Like, I mean, we were doing deals in Fresno, Vegas, St. Louis, Washington, all over the place. I mean, it definitely works. If you put out enough volume, it works. But our growth really came. Our real growth in the past couple of months have really come where we narrowed down to one area, understood how to comp in that area, really built relationships with the buyers in that area, understood the zoning in that area, and got more targeted. And that's been, I mean, now we're spending probably 60% less on marketing and, you know, driving the same amount of revenue.
What market or markets are you solely in at this point?
We're just in the 4 main counties in Washington. So Thurston, Pierce, Snohomish, King, and a little bit of Spokane.
You said zoning. How important is that in some of those counties?
You know, it's pretty important, not because you can't do deals without understanding that, but because you're missing out on a lot of money if you don't understand it. An example is I have a buddy who just lost a deal in Kirkland, who's a really nice area. And he someone else came in and offered $100,000 more because they understood the zoning, and they still made $75,000 on it. So yeah, I don't think it's a absolute necessity when you're first starting out to understand zoning. But it's definitely something that helps maximize deals.
Yeah. That's why I bring it up. You can definitely make your way through this business, but especially in the Seattle area, it's, you know, zoning adds a lot of value to stuff. And so being aware of it, and I know generally people seem to be more aware of it up there. I think people in general are getting more aware of it just overall, but like 4 years ago, 5 years ago here, zoning was like a real estate investor would get a lead. They'd look at the lead sheet and be like, address, what they want, 3-2. Okay. That's how we're valuing it, right? Nobody even looked at zoning or lot size. Now, obviously, that's changed. But up there, you know, the importance of that is even greater than here because your price points are even higher.
It's massive, yeah. I mean, to really do a deal, like a good deal in, you know, Bellevue, it's usually a zoning deal. You're not doing wholesaling, just a lot of single family, easy flips in Bellevue. I mean, yeah. You're finding something that's a full scrap because they can build two houses on it right next to each other.
All right, so let's talk about the deconstruction of the Titanic. What was that day, first of all, where you said, screw it, we got to, you know, back this thing out. We got to kind of dismantle it here. What did that look like?
Well, I kind of had a burnout period where I had like, it got to a point where I, you know, got so bad where it was like 2 months of, I wasn't really working that much. It was just too much chaos. So we let go a lot of our sales staff, and me and my partner went our separate ways. And I mean, it was a complete reset, but it was a slow buildup. It wasn't like woke up one day, this isn't working. It was a lot of signs building up and a lot of pressure building up to the point where we couldn't function as a business anymore. Like to feed that Titanic at that point, we were pretty close to, you know, putting out, I mean, you put out, you know, $60,000 in marketing in a month. If you have one or two bad months, you know, we didn't have enough cash and reserves at the time to take that hit.
So just so I know and everybody else knows, you were putting out 60K a month in marketing. What were you guys holding in reserves when you were spending that type of marketing?
Well, 60 was like that last month when me and my partner Paul at the time were like, hey, someone's wrong here. But most of the time, 30 to 40.
Okay.
We had, you know, around double that liquid.
Okay. Yeah. So about 2 months.
Yeah, about 2 to 3 months reserves. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys were betting big.
Yeah. I mean, I talked to Taro a lot about this, but I'm still all in. Like at my age, I feel like I can't really lose. Like worst case, I just learn a bunch and start over.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I don't know if you know Danny O'Bannon, but when he first started growing, he was like, I'm either going to succeed or I'm going to crash and burn like a mofo. I was like, well, yeah. fortune favors the bold. So I'm sure you'll be all right. But you are right. Being younger, not having, you know, kids, family, things like that. I mean, you really only got to take care of yourself, right? So, and you'll learn a ton along the way. But I guess the one thing I remember, because I built a mortgage company before this, and I remember the day where I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. It's just not working. And then, of course, I got into this side of the business, but it was that same feeling of burnout and like, I just don't want to do this. And I remember the first person that I had to fire because I just wanted to change everything. And it was challenging because it happened to be my best friend's girlfriend. But do you remember the first person you let go when you started deconstructing things?
Yeah, it was a friend. So it was a friend. I was able to get him a job at a different buddy's company.
That's good.
Do different stuff. So I was lucky there. But yeah, we hired a lot of friends at first, and it was not easy to, you know, kick him out the door. So yeah, that was a big learning experience, was learning how to manage relationships outside of the office and inside of the office and make those blend.
That's just called being a business owner, right? Yeah. Learning those skills, because that's a different skill set than this whole real estate investor thing, this whole marketing thing, right? I mean, when I see a lot of young guys out there doing stuff, I'm always rooting for them because that was me, you know, old guy me going, yeah, right now. But, you know, back then I was super hungry and wanting to do stuff. But you can learn the real estate game, you can learn the marketing game, but it takes time to learn the business game and just how to manage people effectively.
And money.
Right people, all right seats.
Yeah, that's been the biggest thing. The marketing stuff's pretty straightforward, but the business lessons that I feel like really you can only learn with time. Is what really lets, like where we're at now, letting us scale the right way. Yeah.
All right. So you dismantled the machine. You send some people on their way. You got them some jobs where you could. What does the version now look like that's put back together in a way that you actually like and you kind of regrouped from?
Yeah. So smaller team. So it's five of us now. We have a big virtual staff, like in-house working together. It's five of us now. And then we're really, really, really targeted with our marketing. So we're spending no more than 10 to 15 grand a month on marketing. And we want, you know, at least a six times return on that. And we're not stretching to all kinds of different markets. We're staying really consistent with our markets we're in. We're spending a lot of time building relationships with buyers and people that actually have access, especially with what's going on right now with COVID. Like we had a deal 2 months ago when this whole thing first started, which was a great deal, but if we wouldn't have had built really good relationships with people who have access to money at all times, because hard money dried up at that time. Like no one would have been able to buy that deal. So I was able to partner with someone on it and get it done. But yeah, a lot of time building relationships now. The marketing and system side of our business is pretty much set up. But just a lot more focus on, like you were saying, the business operation side, you know, getting more into figuring out who's the real players in our market so we can, you know, exit each deal in the best way.
So what do those five people do? Like, what are their roles?
So yeah, we have two guys, only two guys on our sales team now. So each of them are responsible for two different counties. So Mike has King Pierce, Josh has Snohomish and Thurston. So they're going on appointments, they're on the phone locking stuff up. They're handling those two counties. And then we still have a virtual guy. He was in the office, but now he's not, but he runs all of our books. He runs all of our, you know, QuickBooks. He does all of our payments for commissions and salaries, that kind of stuff. And then me, I still do a little bit on the dispo side, just because I like doing it. And then we have someone who's in and out, kind of a little bit in the office, but no transaction coordination.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So then the 10 to 15K a month that you're spending on marketing to drive revenue, how's that mm-hmm. broken up right now?
Yeah, so we spend about $2,200 a month on across Facebook and SEO stuff. So marketing across all kinds of different platforms. We'll spend $4 to $5 a month on pay-per-click, and depending on the month, and the rest is the other $10,000. You know, SMS, cold call, RBM spread throughout those three.
Gotcha. So no direct mail.
No, we've never really gotten into mailing. I don't know if it's just for some reason. My brain works in a way where I want results. Like I want to be in control more of the results. So we've never really gotten too deep into direct mail.
It's funny that the more of you young guys that I talk to, the more of you are like, direct mail, who does direct mail? And then old dinosaurs like me, I guess, are, you know, direct mail, you know, everything. So but it's good to see, because you can do this business two different ways. You know, the advent of, you know, text blasting and ringless voicemail, I think really changed the business a few years ago, but it's crazy. So you're also doing pay-per-click, which I know a lot of people used to do. They don't do a lot now because the cost is just so high per click, but you're obviously getting an ROI on that.
Honestly, we don't even really care on Facebook and pay-per-click if we get deals from it. It's more about building our brand. Okay. So we can send people to our Facebook page and websites and they can see reviews. And so it kind of generates, you know, more of a legit feel. Because I know so many guys that are, especially have wholesale companies that have very thin brands, like no one knows who they are. And they're calling and texting these people who can't verify them in any way. So that's more, $5,000 probably isn't going to get us a deal every month on pay-per-click, and $2,000 on Facebook isn't either, but it's going to save other deals because people are going to be able to see that we're an actual brand.
Gotcha. So HelloPad's the brand that you're building then.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Right on. So then the, I guess texting, right? What's the texting look like? Like in terms of, are you guys texting just as many lists as you can? Or are you stacking data and then texting those people? Are you sending them a specific type of message based on the list?
Yeah, we stack stuff, but we pretty much text everyone in our database. We just changed it to our acquisition guys are the ones that are handling both the outbound and inbound texts live. So they use a click-to-text system where they have an inbox, so they're able to, you know, real-time, 2 minutes, respond. And they're hitting their, you know, their warm follow-ups, hot follow-ups in the mornings, and then they're running their texts, cold call stuff later in the afternoon. So we just switched to that. For a while, we had it all outsourced. We text everyone. I think a lot of people overcomplicate marketing in this business and try to sell stuff around it. But it's really just about being consistent every single day, getting contacts out to people, whether it be texting, mail, door knocking, and then being persistent on a follow-up once that person comes into the system.
It is pretty simple when you break it down like that, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts and it's a moving target for sure, but a lot of people fall into the trap of overcomplicating it.
So let's talk about the cold calling that you guys are doing on top of that. What lists are you pulling that ultimately you're stacking to call from?
Yeah, so we pull, you know, the normal kind of hotter stuff. So we pull tax delinquents, pre-foreclosures, probates, code violations, vacants, and then our kind of bread and butter is still kind of absentees, higher equity stuff, in-state and out of state. And then we'll stack a mix of those and hit those first, but eventually every single one of those people are going to get touched.
Gotcha. With your KPIs, which over time, what do you say is the best, the best performing list as far as actual contacts to deals, or is it spread out?
It's kind of a misleading KPI because the hotter lists are so small that there's not that many people there. So if we had a massive list of those hot leads, our deals from that list would outnumber our absentee list like 10 to 1. But since those lists are so small, we get them once a month and there's so little, our absent on paper, you'd be like, oh, holy crap, they're doing over a year, they're doing X amount of deals from absentee and 10% on these other lists. So it's kind of a misleading KPI, at least the way we look at it. But I just think you can't really go wrong with that absentee list either way, with volume, whatever you're doing for door knocking, putting up bandit signs, like targeted bandit signs, which I know a lot of people do, mailers. I think that's because you can get a large volume of those no matter what market you're in, and you can be really consistent.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about your smaller lists are going to yield smaller amount of deals, right? So it is kind of a misleading KPI. What are the, I guess, your biggest KPIs are the ones that you track on a daily, weekly basis to be able to run this kind of, you know, 5-person machine now?
Yes, we track on the marketing side, we track lead to contract days. We track contract to close days. We track contract falling out percentage, so how many of our deals are actually getting to the closing table and we're getting paid on. We track calls per day, offers per day, closings per day, and then the same metrics on a weekly basis. And we have transaction reports for, how long is our average contract to close across every marketing stream. So we know kind of if we put out 30 grand, we know when we're probably going to get our money back.
Wow. Yeah, you guys have it down pretty good. What's the pay structure look like for your sales guys now that you're kind of a little bit more mature business or a little bit more mature business?
So there's 20% across the board now.
Okay.
Yeah, so they get paid no matter what the deal size, they get 20%.
And there's no supplemental salary?
No salary. When they first started out, they get 3 months of a draw. So kind of like a car dealership, they'll get $2,000 a month. But
are you equating yourself to a car dealership? I'm kidding. Yeah,
parts of the business. Okay.
No knock on car guys, but you know.
We've tried all kinds of different pay structures. We tried the 8% with a grand a month. We've tried 12% with a grand a month. We've tried 7.5% with no salary at one time, and the past couple of months at 20% has been really comfortable for both the sales guys and the company in terms of, they feel like they're getting paid and they're part of the company.
Yeah, I mean, 20% is it's a generous number. I mean, I don't know. Would you say that's on the higher end of what? I mean, that's
definitely on the higher end. I thought it was too. And then James Daner convinced me because he pays the guys good. Like, and he has guys that have been with him for years and years and years and years and years. And I didn't want to have a revolving door constantly training guys. So I'm like, I can pay them 10% now and they'll leave eventually, or I can pay 20% and that 10% will be saved by not having to train new guys every 3 months.
Wise words from Mr. Daynard, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the cold calling machine then right now. So you guys, you're not calling in-house. You've got, you have a calling for elsewhere then that generates the leads, and then your guys in-house call them back and kind of, okay. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so it's a company that, you know, we're an affiliate for now. We've used them for years and they're really, really good. They're experienced in real estate, and we pretty much just send down our data, and then they send back leads every day, and it's consistent every single day. Our guys don't now, we cold call only for a year and a half, but now when our guys get in the office, they kind of get scared of those cold calls. We have to have sales meetings every week reminding them that you still have, these are, you know, longer follow ups, but these are still deals you guys need to be following up with. So it's gotten they've gotten less motivated to hit those as hard, but it's still, we're doing a solid deal or two every month off just pure cold calling.
Yeah, it would seem like that 20% number would help motivate them, let's say, because I noticed that too. I'm like, there's the list, there's the leads, you know, go get them. And it's like, what else can I do right now, right? Yeah, and that's normal, right? I mean, those are the scariest leads generally.
Those are the people that, even if they said yes the first time, they're in a different mood the next day. And you get on the phone like, F off, I don't want to talk to you. And yeah, never call me again. So definitely.
What kind of CRM are you using to kind of manage all of this and make sure that you're doing the proper follow-up on everything?
Yeah, so we, after using all kinds of different ones, we built out our own over the last year that pretty much tracks everything. It does all the follow-ups automatically, from texting to follow-ups to email follow-ups to all of it. And all of our KPI tracking is in there. So all we do is export reports out of our KPI tracking app to look at our numbers. And yeah, a lot of trial and error there too. I think that's another thing I think people overcomplicate when they first get started. They want this perfect system that does everything for them. And it's, they'll spend all their time focused on that rather than just picking up the phone and calling someone. So I think it's definitely something that where we are now, we need it and it's awesome. But to most people that are starting out, they don't need to overcomplicate the CRM side either.
Yeah, I think people are a little bit too reliant on technology early on. Obviously, there comes a threshold where you need it, but you know, everybody wants to push a button and have it do everything for them, right? I mean, that's, which I guess we're in that type of society now, so it's normal. But, you know, back 2010, when we first started doing direct mail, it was before we built our Driving for Dollars app. We actually had to drive around and write down addresses, and then we had to go back and manually look stuff up. And then we had like an Excel file, and that's how we managed everything. And there was this thing called Salesforce, and that was pretty much it, you know, that you could, you know, use, or Zapier maybe. But it's crazy how much more technology is out there. But I think people get overly consumed by it too.
It's like analysis paralysis big time on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it really is. All right. So taking it full circle here, you've gone from getting started, blowing up this huge company, which had great top line revenue, not so great bottom line revenue for the owners. Mm-hmm. Now you're operating a more lean.
It looked good on Instagram.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of stuff that looks good on Instagram right now, right? And, you know, I mean, to be honest, I don't know how many of these big operations, I don't know what a lot of their bottom lines are, but, you know, you got to do a lot of money every month to support a lot of staff. I mean, same with the car lot, right? If you have, you know, admin people, sales people, support people, you know, and you have your marketing costs, I mean, you just start doing the math. It's like, well, you know, you bring in $100,000, you probably got a 20% profit margin on that after paying everybody. And if you've got two partners, that's 10 grand a piece, and you're running this monstrous business with huge overhead, and is it really worth it, you know?
That, actually, to go back to our that question of what kind of sunk the boat, is at that point I looked at that, like, so the amount of effort I'm putting in, I could go do these 100 other things to make the same amount of money I'm making by doing this. That's, I think that was the final thing that clicked that made us kind of turn the ship.
Yeah, which, you know, it's good you did it then, right? A lot of people hold on a lot longer, so yeah. And that's, you know, I remember seeing that a while back, and that's why we, you know, our business is a lot different than yours, but I was like, well, let's see, we can make 200, 400 grand in a month, and we can do like one deal or two, you know? And so it's like, but it's a different model. It's a different thing. But, you know, instead of doing 15 rehab or 10 rehabs at 30 grand a piece, right? Which that hamster has to run awfully damn fast on that wheel. And there's a lot of friction with 10 rehabs going at any given time. I'll tell you that. So
yeah, it's a lot of moving targets there too. And the more staff, the more complicated, the more things can go wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. More staff means more problems generally for most people anyway. All right. So people that are thinking about either going big or, you know, building something like you've got now with the experience that you've had, you know, what are some things that you would tell people, you know, to keep in mind, or, you know, in terms of building a business, maybe not building what you see online, but build what you want for yourself. I mean, what are some takeaways from this process? Because you've been through a lot at, you know, how old you are.
I think it's the shiny object. Don't chase the shiny object. So when I was getting started, you know, I'd go on Instagram and I'd see these guys with these $100,000 checks, and they had these 20-person teams in the office, and like, that looked amazing. It looked like they were barely working behind the scenes. All they were doing is taking pictures all day. So naturally, especially the age I was at, like, that's what I want. I think that's the direction to go in. Let's go full steam ahead. But I would urge people to really like sit back and say, you know, what do I really value? What do I want to put my time into? Do I want to spend 12 hours a day working for that amount? Or do I rather spend 3-4 hours a day working for, you know, this amount and have a leaner operation? And don't fall in love with like the bigger is better part of it, because it's not. It's really about being efficient with your time and money and resources, so you don't get in the trap of, you know, having this giant machine you have to feed, and work 10 hours a day to feed and not see much return for that. So, yeah, I mean, there's an endless list of little lessons I learned through this whole process I could go through, but the moral of the story is to, you know, don't be so aggressive, and, you know, I guess the grass isn't greener on the other side.
Yeah. I agree.
Pretty cliche, but it applies 100%.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to, right? I mean, you see stuff online and it's like, I mean, here, watch. I'll show you this and we'll see how you feel, right? By the way, I never put this stuff online because I just think it's so ridiculous. But there's a check, right?
I can't see it. It's a little.
Is it blurry? It says $2.975 million. So, but, you know, I could put that online and it looks great, you know, looks awesome for, you know, whatever, people that are watching. But the reality is there's a lot more behind it, right, that you just don't see. And so I think that's a good advice. We're just in a, I mean, there's a lot of bling, there's a lot of cars, there's a lot of whatever online, and people just get distracted by it. And you do think bigger is better. I mean, and you, I don't know, you have to know what you want and your personality and, you know, does it fit? And the other thing that, you know, is a good lesson from this is, do you have a partner now in the new iteration of what you have, or is it just you?
I have the sales guy that's been with us forever, Mike, who's working his way into equity. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. So what would you say about partnerships? Because I think that's a thing that people, they make mistakes, at least starting out. Like when you get in the business, they're like, hey, you like real estate? I like real estate. High five. Let's partner. Right.
I would say have really, 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 really clear expectations of roles on both sides. And don't be afraid, even if it's your friend, to hold them accountable to that. So as you grow, you feel like you're both contributing the same amount to what you're building. Because otherwise, no matter how much you like each other, there's going to eventually come a time where your brain starts to kind of pick apart everything they're not doing that you feel like you're doing. And it gets messy. And most breakups with partners are not pretty. Usually it's a lot of money, a lot of time. It destroys friendships. So, yeah, I think partnerships are awesome, but I think have a kind of like an end goal in mind and understand that it's probably not going to be forever, and make sure everything's out in the open.
Yeah, I think, and you got to have complementary skill sets, right? I mean, what is it that you're both liking real estate isn't really enough, you know, to make a long-term partnership work. But, you know, the other thing too that I've learned about this business is that you don't necessarily need partnerships all the time. I mean, certain things you do, but to run the type of business that you're running, to have somebody like you, I think his name's Mike, right? You know, if you can give them some equity, some ownership, and you have a great number two that has some great upside, in my opinion, that's the best version of this business, because now you have a partner, but you still have complete control and they're vested with you. They're not leaving you.
I think strategic partnerships are the way to go, especially in this business. Like he does everything I don't want to do and I'm not good at. He runs the whole sales team now. I don't have to worry about anything at all. No, I don't hire, fire, or talk to any of the sales guys. And same goes for like when I want to go do a flip. It's way better to have, you know, find one partner for that deal rather than find a guy and say, hey, every single flip from now until the time we die, we're doing together.
That's a big ask.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think strategic is the way to go. For sure.
Definitely. All right. So last question then, before I, you know, people can kind of find you, what does the business look like over the next 12 months? Where do you want it to go? Are you happy with the size? You just want to up deal flow? What tweaks would you make looking forward? Cause you're an entrepreneur, so I'm sure you're looking forward to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always looking how to, you know, ways to optimize our system and processes on my end. I wouldn't say that there's a certain goal in terms of revenue in the next 12 months, but we do want to start, you know, building our team out a little, you know, try to push that 10 person number again, but the right way. So being really detailed in metrics we have to hit in order to hire the next person. So we do want to go that direction. I want to do a lot more personal flips and start buying a lot more personal rentals as well in the next 12 months. So there's no major tweaks in that, just pure wholesaling side, but we want to start diversifying a little bit.
Gotcha. I never even asked, but have you done any personal flips to this point of your own?
I've done two with a partner. And they've both gone really well, actually. So, yeah.
Right on. Were they the ones that managed kind of the construction and what went on, and you just provided inventory?
Yeah, I just brought the house and they did everything else. I got to learn the processes and systems and whatnot too, so it worked well. And then, yeah.
I mean, that's a good partnership when you're the guy providing inventory and then you get the guy that knows the construction process and management. See, that's a good partnership, a good strategic partnership, right?
So, really good partnership, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the beauty of that one, which I'm sure you've already learned and you'll learn more, is that you can do less and make a lot more with the more of that you do as opposed to passing off. But I know in Danny's situation, he buys those properties from the wholesale company to let the wholesale company make some money, and then he takes them and renovates them and resells them. So, you know, you could probably set up some type of structure like that.
On the last one that we did, the company got paid up front, and then I took my portion on the back end. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a good way to do it. That way everybody gets, you know, you got to keep everybody motivated, right? Money keeps people motivated. All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you taking the time today. For those people, so I know you guys are going to be probably doing something cold call wise that, you know, we'll probably announce a little later. But for those people that want to get in touch with you now and then they can find out a little more about the cold calling stuff later, what's the best place for people to go to kind of learn more and connect with you?
Instagram is awesome. It's at Cole Rude Johnson, no spaces, no anything. And then also email is cool. It's Cole at HelloPad. Honestly, I answer emails faster than like texts and phone calls. So email or Instagram is probably the best two ways to get a hold of me.
Yeah, you were pretty quick on email. So yeah. I'll vouch for it. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah, right on. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you hopping on today and kind of talking about the business. You've done a lot in your short time in the business and really on this planet. So kudos to you. As I told Elliot on the phone, you're like a phenom type that by the time you're my age, you're going to make me look like I should be on food stamps.
When I'm 25.
Yeah, right. I'm 40 now. Across 40 a couple months ago. So, but anyway, I appreciate your time today, and I'm sure everybody else did as well.
Awesome. I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on.
No problem.